so she would mimic the reactions of others to appear normal and fit in. Looking back, she'd done the same thing at Christmas, when she'd copied the others' reactions when opening her presents. Likewise, when I pointed out a beautiful sunset, she might repeat the phrase, "What a beautiful sunset!" But again it sounded hollow, as though she couldn't actually see or appreciate its beauty. Some weeks later I arrived at the school to collect Jodie at the end of the day. As she came down the corridor, I saw she was being escorted by the head, rather than Mrs. Rice. I took a deep breath and braced myself. What had she done now? We exchanged hellos, then he took me to one side, out of Jodie's earshot.
"Don't worry," he said. "She hasn't done anything. I just wanted a quick word. Mrs. Rice has decided to take some time off, so we have a new teaching assistant starting tomorrow."
"Oh, I see," I said, taken aback. "It's rather sudden. She didn't mention it. I hope she's okay."
He nodded. "I think she just needs to take some time out. You know what it's like working with children, and TAs tend to be on the front line, like you foster carers."
I nodded in agreement.
"Sometimes you just need a break, don't you?"
"Yes, I know the feeling," I smiled weakly, wondering if I would ever get the break I'd been promised at the beginning of the year. As I left, I felt sad for Mrs. Rice. I'd seen her upset often enough to realise that Jodie was partly responsible for wearing her out. She wasn't used to hearing about the awful things that Jodie had been through, and she'd never dealt with a child this difficult and disturbed before. Jodie was constantly on edge and alert for danger, fight or flight. If she heard the slightest noise, she'd spin round, ready for action. When you spend long enough in company of a child like Jodie, you can soon find yourself on a heightened state of alert, and it becomes very difficult to switch off and relax. I certainly felt myself becoming increasingly overwhelmed by Jodie's life and all the pain, fear, and distress she had suffered. Chapter 27. Silence. The poet T.S. Eliot wrote that April is the cruelest month, and it seemed that this year he was exactly right. As April approached, the gloomy days and permanently grey skies gave no hint of anything different in the past or the future. The winter seemed endless as the temperature plummeted. It was hard to believe that Jodie had been with us for almost a whole year, but the anniversary of her arrival was near. I drew up my collar and loitered outside the travel agent's window. I fantasised about the cut-price offers to the Caribbean. How I'd have loved to put us all on a plane and head for an island in the sun. But it was impossible. Although my purse might just have coped with it, I knew Jodie wouldn't. On top of all her other problems, she'd become so fearful of adults that even a visit to our local newsagent, with whom she previously used to chat, would now produce a panic attack. A packed flight would have been intolerable for her, and I doubted the airline would charter a plane just for us. I moved away from the tempting window display and turned towards the supermarket. My mobile phone rang. It was the school secretary.
"I'm sorry, Kathy," she said. "Jodie's inconsolable. She's convinced her father has come to take her. Can you come straight away?"
I turned and headed back to the car. Fortunately, the roads were quiet, so 20 minutes later I was walking down the path towards reception. A high-pitched scream erupted from inside, and I knew it was Jodie. I pressed the security buzzer and the secretary showed me through to the medical room. Jodie was clinging to the radiator, her eyes wide and staring, her body rigid with fear.
"Don't make me go with him! Please, Kathy, please!" she begged.
The new assistant, Miss Walker, who got on well enough with Jodie, knelt beside her, talking softly, trying to reassure her, but I could see Jodie was way past that. I moved towards her, but she backed away.
"No one's taking you away, Jodie," I said firmly. "He's not here, I promise, and you know I don't lie."
She opened her mouth, about to scream, but I didn't give her a chance.
"No, Jodie, I mean it. Stop it. There's no one here. Now calm down, let go of the radiator, then we can have a cuddle."
The young assistant eyed me suspiciously. Jodie looked from one to the other, then at the door. She started to relax her grip.
"Good girl, that's better."
She finally let go.
I went over and took her in my arms as Miss Walker quietly slipped out.
"He was here," she sobbed, "at my old school. He came to collect me. Then we went in his car."
The rest was muffled by her sobs, but I knew how it would go. The past had once again transposed itself onto the present, with flashbacks that felt as real now as when the abuse had happened.
"It's all right, pet, I promise you. It won't happen again. There, there. It's okay."
Once she was calm, I led her to the car and we drove home. It was 11 in the morning, but she wanted to go straight to bed. She said she was tired and her bed was nice and safe. I took her upstairs and helped her out of her uniform. I tucked her in and she fell asleep straight away. I came back every half hour to check on her, but she didn't stir. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I decided to go in and wake her, as I knew if she slept too long, she'd be up all night. She had changed position and was now lying flat on her back. Her eyes were open and she was staring at the ceiling. "Feeling better?" I asked, but she gave no acknowledgement. I opened the curtains, took her jeans and jumper from the wardrobe, and laid them on the bed. "Put these on, pet, and I'll make you a snack. Then we could take your bike to the park for a bit. You'd like that." Usually she was adept at telling me exactly what she did or didn't like, but this time she made no sound or movement. I looked closely at her. Then I perched on the bed and eased the duvet from under her chin. "Jodie, are you all right, sweet?" Her eyes were focused on some distant point above her head. I tried chivying her along. "Come on, get dressed while I make you a sandwich, then we'll go out." She remained staring, giving no clue that she'd even heard me. I decided it was probably best to leave her, in the hope that she'd think about the park and rally round. A quarter of an hour later, when she still hadn't appeared, I went up to check on her again. She was exactly as I'd left her, flat on her back and staring into space. I sat on the bed and started talking, reassuring her that I understood how difficult it was, but that eventually everything would be sorted out. She had her whole life ahead of her. Still, she said nothing and remained immobile. I tried firmness, then coercion, then bribery, then finally I tried to physically lift her from the pillow, but none of it worked. She flopped back like a rag doll, and I was really starting to worry. I hovered in the doorway, then, leaving the door wide open, went to the phone in my bedroom. I called Jill and told her about the day's events. "It could be part of the post-traumatic shock," she said. "The flashback she had at school could have caused her brain to shut down for protection." "So she'll come out of it?" "She should be recovered by the morning. I suggest you let her sleep it off. If you need help during the night, call the emergency social worker, but I doubt it'll be necessary." I returned to Jodie's room and tried once more to rouse her. When this failed, I reluctantly closed the curtains and came out, leaving the door ajar. A little later, the children arrived home, and I explained what had happened. They came with me as I checked on her every half hour, but there was no change, and an eerie hush descended on the house, as music and televisions were kept low. By the time I went to bed, her eyes were closed, and she seemed to be sleeping. I left her light dimmed and her door open, and went to my room. At 4 in the morning, I was woken by a small voice outside my bedroom door.
"Kathy, Amy's wet the bed."
I leapt up and hugged her. "No problem." At least some part of Jodie was back. I changed her sheets and pyjamas as she continued chattering in her baby voice.
"Amy's good girl. She tells Kathy, Amy wants potty."
I didn't mind. Anything was better than that dreadful comatose silence. I tucked her in, then left her snuggled up with a teddy, contentedly sucking her thumb. In the morning, I was surprised to find Amy was still in occupation, and she remained so throughout breakfast.
"Stop babbling in that silly voice," Lucy eventually snapped. She was never at her best first thing in the morning.
I shot her a warning glance. "I'm sure she'll be gone by the time we get to school," I said.
But an hour later, as I kissed Jodie goodbye and passed her over to Miss Walker, she toddled off, still in character as Amy, with the tottering gait of an infant just learning to walk. As I drove home, I got stuck in traffic, so I phoned Jill from the car and updated her. She asked me to email my log notes over as soon as possible so she could forward them to Eileen, the guardian ad litem, and Dr. Burrows. It was after midday by the time I'd finished typing, and I was about to make some lunch when the phone rang. Please let it not be the school again, I thought. I hadn't even started the housework yet, and I still had to do the supermarket run. It was the school.
Hi, Kathy,
the secretary said, and I braced myself for the bad news.
Mr. West asked me to call to let you know Jodie's been fine today.
Oh, thank you, I sighed with relief. Thank you very much. Jodie's good behaviour continued through the evening, but it turned out to be a false dawn. The next morning she was sobbing uncontrollably, and despite my best efforts, I couldn't get her to tell me why. As I sat on her bed watching her weep, I again felt completely ineffectual as a carer and tried to remind myself that this was no ordinary childhood trauma. By 9 a.m. she was no better, so I phoned the school and told them she wouldn't be coming in for the morning, but that if there was an improvement, I'd bring her for the afternoon. There wasn't, nor the following day. By the end of the week, Jodie had been in school for a total of 1.5 days, and she was deteriorating before my eyes. When she wasn't crying, she was staring into space, removed and distant from anything I could say or do. She was hardly eating, and my previous policy of restricting sweet and fatty foods went out of the window.
"What about a chocolate biscuit?" I asked, trying to get a spark of interest out of her. "Or there's ice cream in the freezer."
But nothing could tempt her, and she was surviving on the odd mouthful of sandwich and occasional handful of crisps. It was extremely distressing. I'd never seen any child like this before, and I was at a complete loss to know how to deal with it or how to help Jodie. I phoned the only person I could think of who could give me support and advice at a time like this. Jill agreed to come round at once.
"This can't go on," she said when she saw Jodie's state, which alternated between the heart-rending crying and total blankness. "She needs help, now."
She phoned Eileen but was told she was on annual leave once again, and the new team manager, Gail, was in a meeting. Jill left a stern message requiring a callback as soon as she was free.
"Jill," I asked, "is it possible for a child this young to have a nervous breakdown?"
"There are cases, yes, but it's very rare." We looked at each other, both thinking the same thing. The extent of Jodie's abuse was rare, so why shouldn't she be suffering a nervous breakdown? If there was any child who was a prime candidate for a complete mental collapse, it was her. Jill tried talking to Jodie, who'd spent all morning propped on the sofa, staring silently into space. It was a slightly different approach to mine. Jill didn't ask her any questions. Instead, she just recounted stories of various children she knew, hoping these would prompt a reaction. However, the end result was the same. A blank stare, which eventually gave way to silent tears. I did the only thing I could. I held her tightly and reassured her it was going to be okay. Jill had nothing else to offer, so she left, saying she'd phone regularly and promised to alert Dr. Burrows. The doctor phoned within the hour and asked to see Jodie first thing Monday morning. She said she'd cancelled an appointment to fit her in, and although I was grateful, I wasn't even sure I'd be able to get Jodie out of the house. I asked if she could make it a home visit.
"I'm afraid not," she replied apologetically. "I'm only allowed to see children at the centre because of the insurance."
I said I'd make sure Jodie was there. The weekend passed and Jodie showed no improvement. The whole family spoke in whispers in recognition of her suffering. We took turns sitting with her on the sofa, reading her favourite stories or trying to involve her in games, but not even the Mary Poppins video could produce a reaction. All she wanted was to go to bed, where she now spent an increasingly large part of the day, and from which it was a struggle to coerce her in the morning. I prayed that Dr. Burrows would have some answers for us. Chapter 28 Assessment. On Monday morning I washed and dressed Jodie, then watched as she sat at the kitchen table, staring into space. Eventually I threw away the porridge she hadn't touched, tucked a packet of crisps into my bag, and helped her on with her coat and shoes. I had told her we were going to see Dr. Burrows, but she was as lifeless as ever. I helped her out of the house, strapped her into her seatbelt and turned up the volume on her favourite sing-along cassette. As we drove to the clinic, she stared straight ahead at the seat in front of her and said nothing. She was completely unreachable, and I wondered if she even knew where she was. We arrived at the clinic and I gave our names to the receptionist, who told us to go straight through to the consulting room. I knocked and entered. Dr. Burrows was arranging crayons on the child-sized table. As soon as Jodie saw the doctor, her previous lethargy vanished and she erupted into a violent tantrum.
"Don't want to! Go away!"
She kicked the small plastic chairs across the room. "All right, Jodie," Dr. Burrows soothed. "There's nothing to be worried about. I'm here to help you."
"Don't want your help! Piss off!"
Jodie covered her ears, screwed up her eyes and screamed for all she was worth. The doctor motioned for me to do nothing, so I stayed where I was, as the cry reverberated around the walls in an agonizing crescendo. Eventually she ran out of breath, and the scream ended as abruptly as it had begun. She lowered her hands and darted to the table, throwing it against the wall. She overturned the toy boxes, kicked the contents across the floor, then turned to the filing cabinet, which had one drawer half open. Dr. Burrows intercepted her. "No, you can't go in there," she said calmly, placing herself between the filing cabinet and Jodie. "That's mine and contains important papers. Not in there." To my surprise, Jodie accepted this, but her unspent anger turned inwards upon herself. She grabbed a clump of her hair and tore it out. At this I got up and restrained her. It might not have been the correct approach in the doctor's eyes, but I wasn't prepared to stand by and watch her harm herself. I held her wrists, then crossed her arms, enfolding her as I did at home. She struggled, spat, and then finally went limp. I led her over to the sofa and put my arms around her. Whether Dr. Burrows approved or not, I couldn't tell. She sat opposite and the room was quiet. I looked at the mess. The floor between us was covered in debris, a sea of destruction. We sat in silence, then Dr. Burrows leaned towards Jodie. Her voice was soft and low, and she was searching for eye contact. "I know you're hurting, Jodie, and I want to try and stop that hurt. You let Kathy help you. Will you let me help you too? It would be really good if you did." It was a relaxed, non-threatening approach, which I was sure had worked with countless children before, but although Jodie was quiet, it was a silence I recognised as being withdrawn. Dr. Burrows gave me a reassuring smile, then repeated her request. Jodie didn't move and gave no indication that she'd even heard. The psychologist tried again, this time rephrasing it. "Jodie, Kathy has told me about how brave you've been. You've had an awful lot to deal with, but I think you're finding this problem is too big to fix on your own. That's why Kathy's here, and that's why I'm here too. Will you let me help you?" Jodie continued staring at some indistinct point a yard or so ahead, remaining as closed off and removed as ever. Dr. Burrows sat back and opened the notepad on her lap. "Kathy, perhaps you could tell me how Jodie's been since we last met. I know you've been worried about her." I assumed this was a strategy to encourage Jodie to share her feelings, so I explained that she'd been doing extremely well, but that horrible memories from her past had been making her unhappy. I gave a couple of examples to make it clear to Jodie that Dr. Burrows knew her history and that she could be trusted. I said that the whole family was very worried, Adrian, Lucy and Paula cared a great deal for Jodie and didn't like to see her upset. Dr. Burrows leaned forward again. I see lots of children who are upset and angry because of things that have happened. It's not their fault. I know ways to help. I help them get rid of some of the hurt so they can be happy again. I'd like to help you, Jodie. The nature of our visit appeared to have changed from assessment to therapy. But unless Jodie engaged and the pathway of communication opened, it would all be in vain. I'd like you to help us, I said, hoping the us might spark Jodie's confidence, but she remained inert, staring straight ahead. Dr. Burrows made another note in her pad. Would you like to play a game, Jodie? She asked. I could bring in the doll's house. I looked at Jodie hopefully, but she made no move. How about a drawing? You drew a lovely picture on your first visit. I've still got it. Jodie didn't even look up. I tell you what. The doctor rose from her chair. Before we do anything, Kathy and I are going to put these toys back in the boxes. Would you like to help us, please? I took my cue, slipped my arm from Jodie, and joined the doctor on the floor. Presumably the aim was to engage Jodie in physical collaboration, in the hope that it would ease her into saying something. But as we repacked the toy boxes and picked up the crayons, I could see out of the corner of my eye that Jodie wasn't even looking at us, perhaps wasn't even aware of us. A few minutes later we finished and returned to our seats. Dr. Burrows made some more notes in her pad while I sat with my arm around Jodie. I couldn't begin to guess what she was writing, but I suppose to her professional eye there were indicators and possibly even a diagnosis, despite Jodie's non-cooperation. She closed her pad and smiled kindly. That's enough for today. Thank you both for coming. I'll be in touch. I was taken aback and wondered if this was another ploy to spark Jodie into communication. The psychologist stood up. I'll see you again soon, Jodie. The session was definitely finished. I looked at Jodie, who was still motionless, wearing the same impenetrable stare. Okay, sweet, we can go home now. I took her hand and lifted her from the chair as the doctor opened the door. As we walked out into the daylight, I had an awful sense of foreboding. Chapter 29. Therapy. My sense of foreboding persisted through the following day. Jodie and I sat on the sofa as I read her one of her favourite rhymes by Shirley Hughes. Bathwater's hot, seawater's cold, Ginger's kittens are very young, but Buster's getting old. In the past she had turned the pages eagerly, repeating the words, enjoying the pleasant sound of the rhyme. Now she seemed impervious, deaf and mute. Jodie's disturbance had reached a new level, and I knew that what I could offer was grossly inadequate. There was something frightening as well as deeply saddening about watching her distress. How far could a personality fracture before it was impossible to put it back together? Where would all her misery and hurt take her in the end? It seemed as though it was leading her to a place of darkness and silence, where finally no one would be able to reach her. I knew she needed help urgently, but what kind of help, and how could I comfort her? I put the book down and held her close as I replayed the previous day's session with Dr. Burrows in my head. I hadn't expected a miracle cure, but I had hoped for at least a hint of progress. Instead, the session had only served to demonstrate how disturbed Jodie was, and how powerless even the psychologist was to reach or help her. I stroked a few strands of hair from her forehead and looked at her pale, unresponsive face. Was it possible that she would be trapped like this forever? I feel so helpless, Jodie, I whispered. I wish I could do something. I wish I was a fairy godmother
and I could wave a magic wand so all your troubles would go away.
I looped my arms under her shoulders, eased her onto my lap, and rocked her gently. She remained impassive. My gaze drifted to the window as a rogue snowflake floated past. It was followed by another, and then another. They drifted down as if from heaven, and then melted as they touched the patio.
"Look, Jodie!" I raised her head towards the window. "It's trying to snow, and it's April!"
She looked up, and her eyes seemed to focus for a second.
"Shall we go outside and have a look? You like snow, don't you? Please look."
But the moment passed, and she turned her head back to the floor, showing no emotion or recognition. I put her to bed at 7, and with the girls at their piano lessons and Adrian coming home much later, I had the house to myself. I tried to read, but I couldn't concentrate. I put on a CD of classical music, but it only made me sad. In the end, I sat watching TV, keeping the volume low so I could hear if Jodie stirred. I went to bed early, and as I lay awake, I prayed for the first time in 30 years. In the morning, I fancied there was some small improvement. Jodie came downstairs on her own and managed a few spoonfuls of Weetabix. Sadly, though, it didn't last. Half an hour later, she was curled fetally on the sofa again, silent and withdrawn. Jill phoned at 9:30. The new team leader had called an emergency planning meeting for 11, and my presence was required. She didn't know exactly why the meeting had been called, but said it suggested things might be starting to move. Dr. Burrows may have recommended that therapy start immediately. Alternatively, if we dared hope, new evidence might have emerged that would finally put Jodie's abusers behind bars. Jill's colleague, Lisa, had offered to babysit and would arrive in about an hour. Finally, some action, I thought. I looked down at Jodie and felt my hopes begin to rise. Lisa arrived in good time, and I introduced her to Jodie, who did at least manage to look in her direction. I showed her where the coffee and biscuits were, then left, as she began reading a Barbie magazine to Jodie. I'd changed into my smart meeting suit, and my spirits continued to lift as I drove to the social services. Perhaps something good was going to come out of this. Finally, other people had begun to understand what I had known for some time, that the extent of Jodie's troubles was extraordinary, and that she needed specialist help and immediate therapy. Someone had to know how to unlock her and restore her to life. I parked in the multi-story car park nearby and took the lift down to the street with 10 minutes to spare. The ornate stone building, which had once been the old town hall, was now surrounded by high-rise flats and retained only the facade of its previous gentility. I heaved open the double doors and walked in. As usual, it was full. People of all ages and nationalities were sitting, standing, or pacing as they waited anxiously for their numbers to appear on the electronic display suspended from the ceiling. As I walked through the melee, a toddler grabbed the hem of my skirt before his mother whisked him back onto her lap, smiling an apology. I approached the reception desk. "Kathy Glass," I said, as the receptionist slid the glass partition just far enough to hear. "I'm here for the 11 o'clock meeting in respect of Jodie Brown. I'm her carer." With stoic resignation, she ticked my name off a printed list, then handed me a stick-on security pass with "visitor" printed in large black letters. I pressed it onto my coat.
Room 7, she said. "Through the double doors, up the stairs, and it's on your left."
The partition slid shut before I or anyone else could poke a head in. I knew the layout of the building, having attended many meetings here in the past. Room 7 was one of the largest, and as I climbed the stairs I realised that it was also where Jodie's pre-placement meeting had taken place almost a year earlier. It was hard to believe that it had been so long. I thought back to that day and cringed at my cavalier assumptions at the time. Back then I'd been in no doubt that all any child needed was care, firm guidelines, encouragement and attention, and I'd had no doubt that this Jodie would end up as another success. I'd been so confident that I would reach Jodie, just as I'd reached so many troubled children, and helped to put them back on the road to recovery and as normal a life as possible. But for once my tried and tested methods had failed me. At least I wasn't alone in not being able to reach the source of Jodie's torment. Nevertheless, I wondered if anyone in Room 7 would show their disappointment. Jill, Sally and Gail, the new team manager, were already seated along two sides of the polished mahogany table. They smiled as I walked in, and Gail introduced herself. I exchanged a good morning with Sally and sat next to Jill.
"We're just waiting for Dr. Burrows and Mary from finance," Gail said. "Eileen's on leave, I'm afraid, and Jodie's headmaster won't be coming, but he has submitted a report."
I slipped off my coat, draped it over the back of my chair, and took heart from the fact that finance had been invited. Usually finance people were only present when funding needed to be found, and funding would be required in order to embark on therapy.
"How is she?" Jill asked quietly. "Pretty much the same, but once she's in therapy, I'm sure things will start to improve." "Let's hope so," she smiled.
The door opened and Mary rushed in, clutching a thick wad of papers. She apologised for being late. She sat opposite me and I was dying to ask how much therapy their budget would stretch to, but I knew it would be poor protocol to do so before the meeting had even started. Gail and Mary spoke quietly between themselves, discussing a different case. Then the door opened again and Dr. Burrows appeared, carrying a briefcase, looking more like a city worker than a psychologist in her smart grey suit.
"Sorry to keep you waiting, but the cab was late."
Gail waited for her to sit down and then opened the meeting. She thanked us all for coming, minuted the date, the time, and the names of those present, and then asked us to each introduce ourselves. After the introduction, she looked down the length of the table.
"We are here to assess the present situation with regard to Jodie and to decide how best to proceed. I think it would be helpful to start with you, Kathy, then Sally, if you could go next. I'll read out the school's report, and perhaps if you would conclude, Dr. Burrows." We murmured our agreement. I'd rehearsed what I was going to say during the drive over. I was going to be positive about Jodie's initial progress, without minimising her need for help. I took a deep breath and began. "As you know, Jodie showed very challenging behaviour when she came to me, to such a degree that she had been through 5 carers in 4 months. She was extremely aggressive and confrontational and suffered from delayed development. She had poor bowel control and very low self-esteem. She exhibited sexualised behaviour towards men and women. Over time, she settled into our household routine and began to respond to the clear boundaries I set and the positive encouragement. As her anxiety decreased, she became less violent and was learning to manage her anger. However, as she began to feel safe, she started to disclose. The extent of the sexual abuse she has suffered at the hands of her family is horrendous. As the disclosures continued, her progress halted and she became increasingly disturbed. Since that time, she has suffered from night terrors, vivid hallucinations, and her personality seems to be fragmenting. Over the last 2 weeks, as you know, Jodie's condition has deteriorated further and faster. Despite all my encouragement and reassurance, she now spends large parts of the day in bed and takes virtually no interest in what is going on around her. She rarely speaks or eats, and I often find her crying silently to herself. In January, she joined the Abbey Green Primary School, where she was supported by a full-time assistant. Initially, she made some progress, but since her deterioration, she's been unable to attend. She's missed more than 3 weeks in total. I looked them in the eye as I spoke and saw concern and disquiet reflected back. I admit I am at a loss to know how to reach Jodie and help her come to terms with her experiences. In my view, she needs the help of a professional psychotherapist. Given our earlier success, I'm optimistic that once therapy has begun, we can resume making progress. Gail thanked me and handed over to Sally, the guardian ad litem. Sally listed the dates when she'd visited and praised my success in gaining Jodie's trust,
which had allowed her to disclose. She said that while she hadn't had the chance to observe Jodie recently, she had been in close contact with Dr. Burrows and Eileen, and was thus fully abreast of the current situation. She'd seen Jodie's parents and made them aware of how badly Jodie had been affected by the disclosures. Jodie's father had been unmoved and was still adamant that Jodie was making it up, but Mrs. Brown had broken down in tears. She said nothing more about Jodie's parents, and with her professionalism, there was no question that she would, but there was an inference that there was not much doubt of their joint culpability in what had happened to Jodie. I felt no sympathy on hearing that Jodie's mother had broken down. My immediate reaction was that it was a sham to cover up her own guilt. I had no doubt that what Jodie had told me was the truth. There was no other way a child of her age could know the things she knew and describe the things she had described. And I only had to look at her disintegration to know that what she had said had happened. I could hardly bear to think about her parents. I hated the thought that they were free to continue their daily lives and whatever degradations they got up to, while their daughter was imprisoned inside the pain and suffering they had caused. What they had inflicted on Jodie had condemned her to a life sentence. "Jodie is a very badly damaged child," Sally concluded, "and my recommendations will be wholly in line with Dr. Burrows' findings." There was silence as Gail made a note. Then she took a sheet from her file and read out the headmaster's report. At the time of writing, Jodie had attended a total of 72 days, and Mr. West had based his observations on both her academic ability and how she interacted with her peers. At present, she was learning to sequence the alphabet and the numbers up to 20. She had no sight vocabulary, but had been working on a target of learning 5 new words a week. Her concentration was very limited, and she was being encouraged to spend longer on tasks and to work independently. She had found difficulty in making friends, largely due to her erratic and strange behaviour. The test results showed she was at about the average level of a 4-year-old in terms of reading and writing. His concluding sentence summed it up perfectly. "Jodie's education and social development are being severely restricted by her experiences, and until these have been addressed, I feel her achievements will be negligible." Gail filed away the report, and I felt my pulse quicken as Dr. Burrows opened her file. She would be the final speaker, and after she had given her recommendations, Mary would do her sums, and then funding would be confirmed, so that we could start Jodie on the path to recovery. I only hoped it would be adequate. My feeling was that she needed at least 2 1-hour sessions a week. "As you know," Dr. Burrows began, "I've been appointed by the court to assess Jodie in respect of the full care proceedings. While this was originally intended to determine the feasibility of her returning to live at home, what has come out since confirms that returning to home is impossible. So I am now addressing the issue of her present mental health." She proceeded to give a clinical appraisal of Jodie's condition, making reference to our last 2 appointments. I appreciated that Dr. Burrows' presence and her report indicated just how seriously everyone was now taking this matter. The psychologist was only supposed to submit her comments at the final proceedings later in the year, but she had stepped outside her remit from the court to give her analysis earlier. What she had observed about Jodie had caused her such concern that she knew immediate action had to be taken, hence her presence at this meeting, despite her extremely busy schedule. I looked along the table at the others as they took detailed notes. The doctor drew to a close. "It is therefore my recommendation that Jodie requires nothing less than intensive, long-term therapy with a paediatric psychotherapist experienced in child sexual abuse." "Thank God," I thought. "All we need now is the funding." "What level of therapy do you have in mind?" Gail asked. Mary slid her calculator in front of her. "Jodie has learning difficulties," said Dr. Burrows, "and functions at the level of a much younger child. As a result, she has difficulty engaging with concepts and retaining them. In view of this, and the severe nature of her condition, I do not think even a high level of sessional therapy would be of any help.
It is therefore my professional opinion that for therapy to have any effect in Jodie's case, it must be constant and immediate. I therefore recommend the best chance of recovery would be in a therapeutic residential unit. I heard the last two words, but it took a moment to sink in. The room fell silent as the others finished writing. I could feel my pulse pounding in my neck and my stomach churning. Jill touched my arm.
"Thank you, Dr. Burrows," Gail said. "That was very helpful."
I could feel their eyes on me as I stared down at my notepad.
"Kathy," said Sally, "how do you feel about this? I know you've become very close to Jodie."
I lifted my head and swallowed. My voice was uneven, and I was struggling to hold back the welling tears.
"It's difficult. I wasn't expecting this. I was hoping that once Jodie started regular therapy, we'd be able to see her through." I paused for a second. "To be honest, I feel it's all been for nothing."
Sally looked at Dr. Burrows, who gently shook her head.
"Even before this present crisis," said the doctor, "I doubt Jodie could have functioned successfully in a normal family. She's deeply traumatized, and it's affecting all aspects of her life. Very few carers would have invested as much as you have, and it's to your credit that she's come this far."
Gail, Sally, and Jill all muttered their agreement. I shrugged despondently.
"Would it not be worth trying sessional therapy for, say, 6 months?"
They looked again at Dr. Burrows. She looked over at me sympathetically. "In my opinion, no. Not only would it not be effective, but it could exacerbate her condition. Jodie's personality is disintegrating, and the longer it's left, the more profound the long-term damage may be." I said nothing.
"What time scale are you looking at?" Gail asked.
"If I make a recommendation immediately, she could be in within a month." I flinched.
"Do you have somewhere in mind?" Gail continued.
The doctor delved into her briefcase and brought out some coloured pamphlets, which he distributed along the table. "It's called High Oaks, and it's run by Dr. Ron Graham and his wife Betty. They're practising child psychologists. You may have heard of them. They're well respected in their field." Jill opened the pamphlet between us, and I stared at the first page. All I could see were blocks of fuzzy print, juxtaposed with pictures of smiling children. I blinked and tried to focus. The doctor continued her explanation. "They've been established for 12 years and have built up an excellent reputation. It's a lovely old manor house set in an acre of wooded parkland on the outskirts of Cambridgeshire. The Grahams live on site together with a support staff of highly trained therapists. The children are taught by qualified teachers who come into the schoolroom in the morning. They cover all the curriculum subjects up to GCSE. The afternoons are given over to recreational activities and one-to-one therapy. At the weekends, they do what other families do, outings to the cinema, swimming, and so on, and, of course, they take them on holiday. I've had close links with the Grahams since they first opened, and they have a very high success rate. 90% of the children eventually move on to live in a family, but, of course, it doesn't come cheap."
"How much?" Gail asked.
"It depends on the package, but for someone with Jodie's needs, it will be approximately £4,000 a week. I would make an initial recommendation for 3 years, but of course that would be under regular review." I glanced up. Mary tapped some figures into her calculator and showed the result to Gail, who made a note.
"Would she be able to receive visitors?" Jill asked, knowing that's what I would have asked if I'd been thinking straight.
"Absolutely," replied Dr. Burrows. "In fact, it's essential. If a child has no family, then High Oaks arranges for a befriender. It's very important that the children maintain ties with the outside world."
"And, Kathy, you'd want to continue contact?" asked Sally.
"Yes, of course," I responded automatically. Gail looked along the table.
We'll have to take it to panel, but as it's your recommendation, it's likely to be approved. Is there anything else?
Dr. Burrows leaned forward. Only to thank Kathy for all she's done and the offer of contact in the future. The others concurred and immediately began gathering together their papers. They dispersed quickly, leaving Jill and me alone. I placed my hands palm down on the table and took a deep breath.
How am I going to explain this to Jodie? She trusted me, and now I've got to tell her she's going. She'll think I've rejected her like the others. What's that going to do for her mental health?
Jill touched my arm.
I know. I'm so sorry, Kathy. Listen, I wouldn't say anything to her just yet. In my experience, these organisations tend to have a set procedure for introductions. I'll contact High Oaks and see how they want to handle it. We'll take it from there.
I sighed and stood up.
Okay, I'd better be getting back. She'll wonder where I am.
Jill joined me in the corridor.
It may not seem like it now, but it's for the best. You couldn't have done any more. You'll be keeping in touch, so she'll know you haven't rejected her. And who knows, 3 years down the line? Yes, I know what you're saying. I understand that it's for the best. The question is, will she?
I walked out of the building, fighting my feelings of failure. Jodie was going to leave me in a worse condition than she'd arrived in. That was a first for any child who'd been placed with me. I could tell myself all I liked that it wasn't my fault, but it was hard not to find that it had all been a waste of time. All those sleepless nights, the endless draining days of tantrums and violence, the scenes in public, the awful mealtimes, the disruption to my children's lives. Now, after everything we'd suffered, Jodie was going to be moved on again. I knew intellectually that Jodie needed proper help and intensive therapy of the kind I simply couldn't offer, not with all the love, kindness and common sense in the world. But still, I felt like I'd let myself down, and most importantly of all, I'd let Jodie down. How could I tell her that she had to leave?
Chapter 30. Green Grass and Brown Cows. That night, while the rest of the house slept, I took out the photo album containing pictures of all the children I fostered. I call it my rogues gallery. I flicked through the photographs. Some of them were posed, others captured unaware, on an outing to the coast or running round the garden. There were children of all ages and races, from little Jason, who was only 2 days old when he arrived, to Martha, an angry and defiant 17-year-old who went on to become a doctor. I'd lost contact with some of them, but many still wrote to me and phoned. 4 of them had stayed with me for a year or more, and all 4 now visited regularly, and had become part of our extended family. As I turned the pages, remembering the children's various personalities and problems, there wasn't one that I felt I'd failed. At least, not until now. There were no pictures of Jodie yet, but when I did come to add them, I knew they would be the last. Whatever aptitude or ability I'd had seemed to have been lost. My confidence was shattered, and I decided I wouldn't foster again. 3 days passed before I heard anything further, and all the while Jodie remained shuttered and distant. I didn't even raise the possibility of school anymore. There was no point. She was in a world of her own. Somehow we got through the days. I read to her, cuddled her, and tried to tempt her to eat, while Adrian, Lucy, and Paula made their own efforts to try and cheer her up. I'd sat the children down not long after I'd returned from the emergency meeting and told them that Jodie would be leaving us. They didn't say much, but their solemn expressions and quiet acceptance told me that they already knew how serious Jodie's condition had become. It was always a sad moment when a child left us, but usually it was in the knowledge that they were going forward in a positive way, back to their families or onto an adoptive family.
and they left us better than they had arrived. With Jodie, there was no such comfort. Despite our best efforts, we had not managed to help her, and no one was unaffected. "Don't blame yourselves," I said, echoing Jill's words to me. "We've done our best. That's all we can do." But it sounded as hollow to them as it had done to me, and I knew that they shared my sense of failure. 4 days after the meeting, a letter arrived from Ron Graham. Inside the envelope there was a letter for me and a second envelope addressed to Jodie. In my letter, Ron introduced himself and wrote that he would phone soon to arrange a visit. In the meantime, would I give Jodie the enclosed? I handed her the envelope as she picked at her lunch. She took it from me suspiciously, then peered at her name on the front. Suddenly, her eyes brightened.
"For me? Who's it from?"
"You'd better open it and find out. It looks very important." I moved her plate away as she carefully picked open the flap and unfolded the pale yellow sheet. It was typed in bold red print, with a little smiley face in one corner. It was immediately appealing.
"For me," she said again.
"Yes. Shall I read it?" She held it between us protectively, and I pointed to the words as I read. "Dear Jodie, my name is Ron, and my wife is called Betty. We have lots of children living with us in a big house in the country. We sort out their problems and have lots of fun too. We are good at sorting out problems, and we'd like to come and tell you about us. We look forward to meeting you. Bye for now, Ron and Betty." It was a simple but cleverly crafted introduction, and she was thrilled at having a letter of her own. She asked me to read it to her again, and then a third time.
"When are they coming?"
she asked, showing more enthusiasm than she had done in weeks.
"I don't know yet. They're going to phone." "I hope it's soon. They sound nice, don't they, Kathy?"
"Yes, they do, sweet." She tucked the letter back into the envelope and carried it around with her for the rest of the day. When Adrian, Lucy and Paula arrived home, she got them to read it to her, and they were as surprised by her enthusiasm as I had been. None of us actually said so, but we were all feeling a little bit slighted. How had one letter from strangers succeeded where months of care from us had failed? That night, when Jodie was in bed, Ron phoned. I told him about her positive reaction. "Children like Jodie very rarely form attachments," he said, instinctively registering my unspoken feelings. "It's no indictment of you, Kathy." He asked about the makeup of my family and how Jodie had interacted with everyone. He explained the introductory procedure. It started with the letter and would continue with a visit from him and his wife the following week. "We never rush the introductions," he said. "Jodie has put her trust in you, and now we have to transfer some of that trust to us." As he spoke, I was impressed by how much of Jodie's background he had at his fingertips. He must have read the file from cover to cover, and we were on the phone for over an hour. It was a relief to talk to someone who seemed to know what they were doing and to be fully conversant with the case. It made such a difference. Although Jill had done all she could, she was just a small cog in an enormous wheel, with very little power to change anything. She could only make suggestions and ask questions. Eileen, Jodie's supposedly dedicated social worker, had proved uncommitted, inefficient and, if I was honest, negligent in the handling of the case. After a year, she still didn't seem to know the details of Jodie's file. Neither had she taken the trouble to get to know Jodie or fulfilled her statutory duties. It was only when I talked to Ron that I felt some of the burden I had carried for so long beginning to lift from my shoulders. I hadn't realised how lonely I had felt. For so long it had been Jodie and me struggling along together as best we could, while the system ground slowly on, hampered by its vastness and bureaucracy. Now, at last, I felt as though someone was truly interested in her. When I asked what I should tell Jodie about their visit, he said to tell her as little as possible, but to write down any questions she had and to reassure her that they would be answered when Ron and Betty arrived. I went to bed feeling happier than I had done in a long while. Jodie had responded positively, and Ron seemed to be sensitive and direct. Perhaps everyone was right, and this was for the best. The following morning, when the others had left for school, I told Jodie about Ron's phone call the night before.
"What's he want?"
she snarled, pushing away the porridge she'd just asked for. I wondered if she understood that Ron was the one who had sent the letter.
"To find out how you are. He wrote you that lovely letter, remember? They're going to come and see you next week."
"Don't want to. Shut up. Go away."
"Jodie," I started, but I decided not to pursue it. I'd do as Ron had asked and take my cue from her. She didn't mention Ron, Betty, or the visit for the rest of the day, and remained silent and withdrawn. At bedtime, I found the letter torn into pieces, scattered across the floor. It would have been ridiculous to ignore this, as I knew Jodie well enough to realise that this was her way of communicating anger. I gathered together the scraps of paper and sat on the edge of the bed.
"I know it's difficult, sweet. It's difficult for all of us. Can you tell me how you're feeling? What your thoughts are? Maybe I can help."
Her face crumpled and she threw herself into my arms. I held her close, her head pressed against my chest, as she cried pitifully.
"What is it, Jodie? Try and tell me, please. I do really want to help."
She thought for a few seconds, then blurted out,
"They'll do what the others did. I don't want to. It hurt. You said it wouldn't happen again."
"Oh, sweetheart, no. They're good, kind people. They'd never hurt you, honestly."
But Jodie's perception was very different to mine. In her world, a new adult usually meant someone new who would abuse and hurt you, with only a handful of exceptions. The idea of any new adult must have been terrifying for Jodie. Ignoring Ron's advice to say as little as possible, I tried to explain. "Ron and Betty are like me. They help children who have been hurt, only they can do it better than me. They know the right things to say. They've helped hundreds of children, and they want to help you. I'll be with you the whole time they're here. All they want to do is to talk. They're going to tell us about the house where they live and the other children who stay there." She sniffed.
"They won't go in my bedroom, will they? And I don't want to go in their car."